Warning, the following podcast may discuss topics of violence that may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, and welcome back to Above and Beyond. As always, I'm your host, Philip Kesterson, and tonight I have a fun episode lined up for you guys. Because tonight is the night that I do the Q&A episode. Over the last week or so, you guys have been sending me questions, and I will do my best to answer them tonight. I will not be able to get to all of them. I may end up doing a second or third episode on a Q&A if I need to, because I had so many, and I thank you all to everyone who sent me one. There's still time if you want to send them to me. Like I said, I may do another episode after this because of how many I got. So there's still time to send it. If you still have another question, feel free to send them in. But before we get into tonight's episode, I have one thing I would like to say. A part of making podcasts is listening to other podcasts, getting inspiration from them, seeing how they do it, or sometimes just for pleasure. I listen to a lot of paranormal podcasts. I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts. And obviously, I listen to a lot of history podcasts. And if you listen to this podcast on a regular basis, there's a chance that you like history, or at the minimum, there's a chance that you like military history. If you like military history, if you like history in general, there's a good chance that you have heard of the HBO show called Band of Brothers. This past September was the 20th anniversary for the release of that show, and HBO came out with a very, very well done 12-part series called Band of Brothers Podcast. It's simply called that. And in it, they go behind the scenes about each episode, and they interview people from the show, like Dale Dye, who served as the military advisor for the series, and he also played Colonel Sink. They interviewed Tom Hanks in the first episode. They interviewed Ron Livingston, who played Lewis Nixon. It's a great series. I will put a link to it in tonight's show notes, and if you would like to go check it out, if you love the series, I implore you to go check it out. It's phenomenal. But we're going to get into tonight's episode. Now, the way I'm going to do this is, this episode is different from the rest simply because it is not scripted. There are some of these emails that I'm looking at for the first time because I want a candid response from myself. And now, obviously, I have chosen questions that either I am interested in, either I really want to answer, or that I feel need to be answered. So we're going to jump right into it with our first question. And now, first question is a good one. It's simply, what event would you like to see in person? This is a very broad question because, I mean, I'm a historian. I have a history degree. I've studied history all my life. It's very hard to pick and choose certain ones, but I can think of a few off the top of my head. Like, the first one would be probably Napoleon's coronation. When Napoleon was coronated, it was different from how they usually are because whereas usually the church would have a part in laying the crown on the ruler's head, but what Napoleon did was he took the crown and he put it on his own head, basically saying that the church doesn't ordain me or the church doesn't coronate me. I coronate myself. Like, I am chosen to be the ruler of France. And I think Ivan the Terrible, a Russian leader, I believe he did that too at one point. And it's this big significant moment. But I would love to have been, because they did it in Notre Dame Church, however you choose to pronounce it, in Paris. I would love to have been in that church or the cathedral when that happened, just to see him grab that and him put it on his head and just look at, like, the bewildered look on the French people's faces where they were like, oh, we are properly screwed now. You know what I mean? Because Napoleon was a great military leader. He may not have been, like, that good of a man, but in terms of military leaders and in terms of, well, emperors, he was pretty top tier. But he also was not liked by everybody. I would love to have been in that church when he did that. Another one I could probably think of, most people know the Winged Hussars from Sabaton's famous song called The Winged Hussars. And their main claim to fame is, in 1683, the Ottoman Turks were besieging the city of Vienna, which is the capital of Austria, and they were pretty close. Like, the city was on its knees. And basically, what happened was the Winged Hussars led this cavalry charge that shattered the Ottoman line, and it stopped their advance into Europe for like ever. The Winged Hussars, I would have loved to see the charge. The charge is what I would have loved to see, because the Winged Hussars, they were elite cavalry. Like, I cannot think of another cavalry force off the top of my head that compares to them, because these were shock troopers who lasted well into the 18th century, and they were like, they would be outnumbered at a lot of battles, and they would still win. I'm pretty sure, and this is, like I said, I haven't done a lot of research necessarily for this episode, because I'm wanting these candid answers, but I'm pretty sure that the Winged Hussars have some of the most, if not the most successful record for a cavalry unit in history, because they very rarely lost. Like, their nickname were the Angel of Death, because one of their big things is that they had these giant wooden wings on their backs that had the feathers of, like, ostriches and, like, geese. When they would come on the field, their presence alone would strike fear into their enemies. And this was 1683. Like muskets and stuff were still happening. Or, like not still happening, but muskets and stuff were just coming into play a lot more predominantly. And cavalry isn't really effective against lines of muskets. But, I mean, I think the last major cavalry charge, or the last major cavalry battle, like cavalry-on-cavalry battle, was in World War II. So, like, 1683 to the 1940s, that period of time, there's still all this cavalry used. But these guys were just, they would go in fast, they would wreak havoc on their enemies, and then they would just be like, see ya, and then they would just go. Like, it's incredible. Like, but yeah, if you haven't heard the song Winged Hussars by Sabaton, I implore you to go listen to that too, because the song's amazing. Sabaton's great. They're a Swedish, they're a Scandinavian heavy metal band that does historical songs, and I'll put a link, if I can, I'll put a Spotify link to that song if I can find one, so that you can hear it. Now, if I had to choose another one, I'm going to try and narrow this down to three. So the first one, I would love to see Napoleon's coronation when he crowned himself Emperor of France. I would love to see the charge of the Winged Hussars at the 1683 Siege of Vienna. I think I would also like to see D-Day. Like, I would love to see the initial charges on the beach, but specifically, and this is because I've been binge listening the Band of Brothers podcast that I talked about at the top of the show, I would love to see Easy Company's assault on Braycourt Manor. And for those of you who don't know, those of you who've never seen the series, this assault on Braycourt Manor was Richard Dick Winters led this small group of Easy Company from the 101st Airborne, 501st Infantry Division. They led it against, I think, four artillery pieces that were shelling the beaches where infantry and rangers and stuff like that, they were landing. So it was very important for these guns to be silenced. And Dick Winters and Easy Company, they made the Germans pay. Like, they took these guns, and the attack on Braycourt Manor was so textbook perfect that 75 years later, at West Point Military Academy today, that assault is still studied and it is still taught, because it was a textbook perfection attack, and I would have loved to just been sitting there watching it just to see how it all unfolded. There's a lot of things from, like, the Easy Company did that I love to see, like, but this specifically, I would have loved to see in person. Okay, this next question is, as I've said in previous podcasts, I am a Civil War reenactor, so this next question makes me, I get asked it quite frequently, or I hear people get asked it quite frequently at reenactments. The question is, why did soldiers dress how they did? Now, the way I'm taking this, because that is literally how the question was sent to me, the way that I'm thinking this was asked is, like, the bright colors. Like, you think of British troops in the 1700s, and you think of these bright red uniforms, or if you think of, like, Prussians or Swedish, you think of these bright blue, or Russians had little green, or French with their bright white. The thing is, one of the main reasons is warfare was a gentleman's game back then. There was a lot more honor in warfare during, like, the 17th, 18th, 19th century than you see today. And for the most part, you were representing your nation. So you wanted to wear these bright colors to basically show off the wealth of your country in some points, because some of these colors, they were hard to get. But you also just wanted to represent your country as a whole. Now, that's one of the small reasons why they dress like this. One of the main reasons that they dress like this is muskets from this time period, they would create a lot of smoke, like a lot of smoke. And it was to the point to where sometimes you couldn't see a soldier or an enemy who was 4 feet in front of you. You couldn't see him because of the smoke. So if a line of infantry comes charging out of the smoke, you have like a split second, like that, you have a split second to think, is this friend? Is this foe? I don't know. But if they are wearing certain colors, you could be like, hey, that's red, he's on our side. Or, hey, that's blue, I'm going to shoot this guy. So that's one of the main reasons. Like, that's probably the main reason. And even though this wasn't necessarily the question, I'm going to, like, sidetrack into this too, because this is another question we get asked a lot. And that is, like, why do soldiers stand at each other, march across the field, and shoot at each other? That's the tactics of the time. You got to remember, with these muskets, you can only, I think, for a Civil War soldier, I can't speak about beforehand because I don't know, but for a Civil War soldier, a trained soldier can fire 3 aimed shots in a minute. If you've ever shot one of these muskets or rifles, you'd understand that's like ridiculous. When you have all these muskets firing one bullet at a time, you get 3 rounds out a minute, you have all these muskets lined up together, you create a wall of lead that you send downrange, and somebody's going to hit something. Whereas if you're by yourself and you shoot, you may or may not hit something. Especially with like 17th century muskets, they were smoothbore muskets mostly. So when a ball would shoot out of it, it would rattle in the barrel, and then it may go up, it may go down, left, right. You may hit your target where you're aiming. You may hit 30 feet to his right. You never know. It wasn't until like rifling was becoming more common in muskets and weapons that you could get aim shots. There were some accounts during like musket and rifle warfare where they weren't using these bright colors. And this was mostly skirmisher units. The British during the American Revolution, they would recruit like mercenaries and people like that who they wouldn't always wear a certain color. The Union Army during the American Civil War, they recruited the help of sharpshooters, and they were known as Berdan sharpshooters. They used all kinds of stuff that like the average infantry soldier in like a regular unit wouldn't use. Like, for instance, most soldiers in the Union Army, they would use a rifle called an 1853 Enfield musket, or like an 1862 Springfield. Like, I believe those were the two most common rifles used during the Civil War on both sides. Berdan sharpshooters were almost always using Sharps breech loading rifles, which means they would load from the rear instead of from the front of the rifle. They would also wear green uniforms because they were running in smaller numbers. There wouldn't be as many as them, but they could also fire faster and they could fire a lot more accurately. They even used things like their buttons on their uniforms weren't metal, they were like rubber, so that the sun wouldn't glint off of them and they would give their position away. But yeah, that's the reason that uniforms were the colors that they were back then. And you can kind of start to see when time progresses on, like warfare evolved, you understand why like uniforms start to have these camouflage, because people are actually trying to blend in more and more. The next question is going to be an interesting one, and it's honestly one of my favorite ones, mainly because I like the topic of this question, but also because it's the first one that actually has a person's name to it. The question is, could the Confederate South won the American Civil War? And this question was submitted by Felix Mueller, I want to say, from Germany. So Felix, if you're listening, thanks for being a fan of the show, and thanks for submitting your question. Now to get to your question. So, could the South have won the Civil War? Now, most historians don't like alternate history. They don't like the what-if aspect. They like the cold, hard facts. I, on the other hand, I embrace both. I love alternate history. I love thinking about like what could have happened, because it's interesting to like hypothesize what the outcomes could have been. The American Civil War is one of those in American history that it's almost always debated. Like, even today, in current politics and stuff, people are still arguing over the Civil War. Like, that's how divided that was. That was 150 years ago. It was 1861 to 1865, and here we are 150 years ago, people are still arguing over it. One of the issues, like addressing the question, the issue with the South is for the majority of the war, they were fighting a defensive campaign. 90% of the battles for the Civil War, they happened in either Virginia or Tennessee. Tennessee had a lot of battles. because of the railroads, because they had rivers and things like that. Virginia, that was Robert E. Lee, the main Confederate general for the South Side. Virginia was his home state, so he fought to defend it a lot more. But in all, most of the war was fought in the South. I think, off the top of my head, and this is in terms of major battles, the South only really ventured to the North two or three times, and these were major battles. These were the Battle of Antietam in September of 1862, and then, of course, the Battle of Gettysburg in July of 1863. The big difference between Northern soldiers and Southern soldiers is that the South had a lot less men, and their men were not as well equipped. The South, their economy was very heavily reliant on agriculture and slave labor that came with it, whereas the North, their economy relied heavily on industry. So when the war broke out, the North, with all of their factories, was able to pump out weapons and even soldiers, because they had a lot more men, ships, all that stuff that the South couldn't really keep up with because they didn't have the means to do it. Now, specifically, the Battle of Gettysburg, this is the turning point of the war. There's a spot at the Gettysburg battlefield, which, by the way, if you ever get the chance to just see one battlefield, Civil War battlefield in your life, go to Gettysburg. It's beautiful all year round. The town is amazing. It's all around amazing. But there's a spot at Gettysburg called the Copse of Trees. Now, during the famous Pickett's Charge on July 3rd, 1863, where I believe 13,000 Confederate troops emerged from the trees and then marched a mile over open ground into Federal artillery and infantry. And it was a horrible failure on the Confederate side. It's one of Lee's, like, major what-am-I-doing moments, you know? There's a spot called the Copse of Trees. The Copse of Trees is supposed to be the spot where all the forces were converge on the Federal side of the field, and they were going to sweep them there. That Copse of Trees is now in the same area as what's called the High Tide of the Confederacy, because that is the furthest north that Lee and his army ever got. But yeah, it is the turning point of the war for that, but also because, at least in my opinion, Gettysburg is one of those places where the war really could have ended. Like, if the South would have won at Gettysburg, D.C. would have been threatened. A lot of Northern, like, if there was a major victory like that on Northern soil, a lot of the Northern population would want to seek peace a lot faster. Now, specifically at Gettysburg, on the first day of battle, people don't understand, not a lot of people understand, like, Gettysburg was a colossal victory for the North. But that first day of battle, they were very, very close to losing it, because they were kind of caught off guard. I hear this rumor that, like, the Battle of Gettysburg was fought over a shoe factory in town. That's not true. Like, if you look at Gettysburg on a map, it's 10 major roads converging on the town of Gettysburg. It almost looks like a wagon wheel. And the roads simply brought troops there, and they just bumped it. That first day was a small skirmish between a northern officer, he's a cavalry officer named John Buford, and then Robert E. Lee himself leading Confederate troops. Now, Lee was a man, Robert E. Lee is probably one of the greatest generals in American history, and if he would have fought for the northern side, the war would not have lasted anywhere near as long as it did. Like, the South had a lot better generals, but specifically, they had Robert E. Lee, and a lot of men fought simply because of that. Now, the thing about Robert E. Lee is he was not really known to yell, he wasn't really known to shout. He would give an order, and he would expect his subordinates to know what he was meaning. And at the first day of Gettysburg, he told a Confederate officer, or a Confederate general, Richard Ewell, he said, "Take that hill if practical." Now, if practical is the main part of this, because that is exactly what he said. He said, "Take that hill," talking about Culp's Hill, he said, "Take that hill if practical." What he meant was, "Take that hill, I'm not asking you to." Now, Richard Ewell thought his men had been fighting all day, and he was like, "Look, my men are tired. They cannot take this hill," and they chose not to take it. But had they taken Culp's Hill on the first day of Gettysburg, then yes, they would have had the high ground. The North would have been pushed out of town, and they would have had to fight somewhere else, and they may not have had, because the defensive line that the Federals had at Gettysburg was phenomenal, and it was probably one of the better ones of the entire war. And if they would not have had that, then they most likely would have lost at Gettysburg. If the South won at Gettysburg, that is how the South could have won the Civil War. That I truly believe that. Now, this next question is kind of open-ended, but not necessarily open-ended. It's very broad, but it's still a good question, and I want to answer it. The question is, what is the most important moment in human history? This is a hard question, because, I mean, like, these other questions, they're narrowed to a time, or there's something I can automatically think of, but this one is, like, this is all of human history. Like, that is, like, tens of thousands of years that people have been walking this earth, you know? So it's, if I had to choose, because, like, yeah, the invention of agriculture was great, and the invention of, like, certain medicines were great and whatnot, but I think the most important moment in human history would be when people started to, like, fix wounds on each other. Like, for instance, I read this piece in one of my archaeology classes a couple semesters ago where these archaeologists found a femur, and it was something like 5,000-6,000 years old, and it was like a femur that it had been very obviously had been mended, like it was broken, and then somebody had fixed it. And it was around a spot that there was a major civilization, so this wasn't just like some lone hunter was out in the wild and broke his leg and then fixed it. Like, he lived somewhere, so most likely someone else fixed it for him. And I think, because if I remember correctly, it was one of the earliest accounts of this type of thing happening. So I think that is the most important moment in human history, was when people started to mend wounds for each other, if that makes sense. Like, it's what separates us from the animals. Because, like, you always hear the expression, a wolf will chew off its own leg to survive a bear trap or whatever. But it's like, a lot of the times in early civilizations, you know, survival of the fittest was a real thing. Like, I hate to say this, but it's like, morbid reality is, you didn't necessarily have to be faster than the bear or the tiger or whatever that was chasing you. You had to be faster than the guy standing next to you. Because if you wanted to get away, you could just trip him or something, and then boom, you were gone. But the fact that this femur was found, I believe it was a femur, the fact that this femur was found to have been mended, it means that somebody got injured and somebody didn't want to leave them behind. So they fixed it. And I think the empathy behind that, like the fact that somebody went out of their way to help fix this person's leg, I think that is probably the most important moment in human history. Okay, this next one is iffy. It's a question that, like, I do study military history mostly, but this question is one that it's hard for me to answer. I'm not knowledgeable enough to answer it, but I will attempt to because I believe it's still important. The question is, why do atrocities occur so much during war times? This is a great question, by the way. You know, you look back, I think, my personal opinion on this one is that I think that, like, humanity evolves in wartime just as much as they do, like, physically and whatnot, in a way that, you know, you look at armies 1,000, 2,000 years ago, like, look at the Roman army, for instance. When they would conquer a land and they would pillage it, they were raping and looting and burning and doing all this stuff and whatnot. If you take an army like that in today's society, they couldn't do stuff like that. Vietnam War, for example, was the first war that was, like, televised on a global scale. Like, it was brought into people's living room. Like, people were firsthand seeing the brutalities of war. And even then, there was occurrences like the My Lai Massacre, where American troops were slaughtering Vietnamese soldiers. And it's a mixture of propaganda behind a country is saying that an enemy country is, like, inferior to you. Like, a lot of American soldiers in the 60s saw Vietnamese as inferior because they were rice farmers, quote-unquote rice farmers, in pajamas and whatnot. But, like, I think, going back to, like, the Roman thing, I think it's, like, if no one's around to see it, you could get away with a lot of stuff. But as time evolves on and people are starting to be able to be seen a lot more, it kind of takes it out. I think that's why atrocities happen the way that they do. There is a really good book called Kill Anything That Moves. It's The Real American War in Vietnam by Nick Terse. And it goes really into detail into a lot of American atrocities that were committed against the Vietnamese people in the Vietnam War. And I highly recommend that book. I'll put a link to the Amazon page in below. But I've read this book, and I've read it twice. And both times I read it, I'm like, why do people do this? And it's like I said, if no one's watching, if no one can see you, you get away with a lot. You know, look back at, like, World War One. World War One was the war to end all wars, and it's one of the deadliest wars in human history. Like, World War II obviously surpassed it, but at the time, World War I was, because there were tanks and grenades and machine guns, like stuff that had never been seen on a battlefield before, were now being seen on a battlefield. There's this one story. It's a German soldier, and I'm getting ready to play an audio clip from it, but I'm going to preface it a little bit. There's a German soldier that he goes into this attack against some French soldiers, and he talks about bayoneting an enemy soldier, and he talks about how it made him feel. And I'm going to play a little bit from that clip, and then obviously, like everything else, I'm going to put the link to the full interview in the description below, and please go listen to this. Like, listen to this man talk. Everybody should have to listen to this video, but I'm going to play specifically this one, or just this part right here.
I felt physically ill. I nearly vomited. My knees were shaking, and I was, quite frankly, ashamed of myself. My comrades, I was a corporal there then, were absolutely undisturbed by what had happened. One of them boasted that he had killed a poor Lee with the butt of his rifle. Another one had strangled a captain, a French captain. A third one had hit somebody over the head with his spade. And they were ordinary men like me. One of them was a tram conductor, another one a commercial traveler. Two were students, the rest were farm workers, ordinary people who never would have thought to do any harm to anyone. How did it come about that they were so cruel? I remembered then that we were told that the good soldier kills without thinking of his adversary as a human being. The very moment he sees him, a fellow man, he is not a good soldier anymore.
So you hear how impactful something like this is. Like he said, he felt physically ill from having to bayonet somebody. But before that, he's actually talking about, he knows that this guy's trying to kill him and that it's either him or it's the French guy. And unfortunately, the French guy had to die in this case. But it's just, atrocities in wartime are, they shouldn't happen, but they do, and they always will, and certain nations will cover them up. I know for a fact that the United States covers up a lot of atrocities, but China covers up atrocities, Russia covers up atrocities. They get swept under the rug sometime, because what a lot of people don't understand, and you don't understand this unless you're in a combat setting, sometimes you do exactly what you have to do to survive. If you look at, going back to Band of Brothers, there's this running rumor throughout that one of the officers named by the name of Ronald Spears, when he landed on D-Day, the rumor is that he gunned down a bunch of German POWs. And it's a prominent theme throughout the entire series where people are always talking about it. It happens. It happens a lot. Like, for instance, on D-Day, the paratroopers that dropped into France, they were behind enemy lines. They couldn't just take a bunch of POWs and carry them everywhere, and they definitely couldn't let them go, because then they would just go and tell their units where they are, and they'd come back and kill the American units. I'm not condoning the violence that was used to kill these men, but sometimes you do what you have to, especially in wartime. Now, going back to the interview, that German soldier's name was Stephen Westman, and he served in World War I. It's about a 5-minute long video. You need to watch the whole thing. Like, the way that man talks, I've never heard somebody talk about things the way that he does. He has such a way with words. He makes you feel like you were there with him. But I'm actually over the normal time that I usually go, so I'm going to wrap things up here, and I will definitely pick back up and do a part two for this one, because I do have a lot more, as I said. Thank you for sticking around to the end. My name is Philip Kesterson. If you would still like to email a question to me or message me on the Facebook page, you can do that. If you'd like to just throw out a shout out and say if you like the show or what you don't like about the show, you can do that too. You can just email me at above.beyondpodcast@gmail.com, or you can message me directly on the Facebook page at facebook.com/aboveandbeyondpodcast. As always, I will see you next week on Above and Beyond.